This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I am coming in tomorrow for just a little bit. My major client has gotten a new computer for me to use, and I've been looking for the best time to cut over to the new system, and I think tomorrow's going to be it. I have a few little questions here and there, but I think tomorrow is going to be it. If it's not this week, it's next week, but the new system is faster and, will probably improve my productivity a little bit. By the same token, we're right in the middle of getting ready to deploy another project. It's always exciting when you move on to a new system. You know, that's not really the time you want to be monkeying around with weird low-level system oddities, but I think it's tomorrow. So I feel a little bit weird charging them for me moving to another system that they got for me, so I'm just going to come in tomorrow and just move the stuff. It won't take me that long to do it, and just do it off clock. Anyways, things are puttering along. Been the first week back from vacation, so of course that's sometimes a little challenging, but, it's been a good week. We've got a lot of good things done. Now that we have the one project I've been working on for the last 3 months, we've kind of got it under control. That actually superseded another project I was working on. But now that we've kind of got it under control and the other programmer I was working with, he's got the ball at this point. You know, we worked on it together, but my pieces are done, so I'm pulling out and moving off to the project I was working on. And so getting restarted on a project that you haven't looked at in 3 months is always interesting as well, but that seemed to go fine. Got everything put back together for that. So have had some real good conversations this week with friends. Very interesting stuff. Writing is going along fine. I'm doing the final proofing on Amanda and the Hare-Footed Flame, which is Farforth Fables 2. Doing some final proofing on that. There's a possibility, if I get my read-through done this weekend, there's a possibility I might be putting together the final copies of that this weekend. Probably it'll be early next week, and then actually releasing that to production, having that out of the way, and then once I get that done, then I can start my research in earnest for Windfall. And I am looking forward to that. That is going to be interesting. Interesting. It's because I'm really hoping to use this whole series as a way to kind of explore my own sense of the role of hierarchy. I was talking to a buddy today who is a small business owner, and we were talking about the fact that there are certain individuals who find it difficult to operate well in life without strict boundaries. But as long as you keep them constrained, mostly through fear, that this has to get done and it has to get done today, they do great. But if you kind of let them set their own schedule, not so good. So, you know, does that mean that for them, strict hierarchy, authoritarian hierarchy, is actually better? There's a lot of interesting questions in this of how hierarchies and organizations deal with those who are a part of that organization. And I'm looking forward to kind of exploring some of those issues in this and kind of settling some things in my own mind. Should be interesting. Should be interesting. Anyways, this week, they announced the Nobel Prize, Health and Medicine, I think it was won by three individuals who have contributed to our understanding of vesicles, I think they're called, and how vesicles operate. A vesicle, if I understand correctly, is a kind of a little fat globule or some kind of membrane globule. It's like a little bubble, and inside it, it has a protein or it has a chemical that it's going to deliver to a given location. And these three each contributed to a new understanding of how the body delivers those with accuracy, not only internally in the cell, but also externally, when those are exported out of the cell. And the body uses this all over the place. I mean, this is what carries the neurochemicals that allow us, our neurons, to fire, and this is what helps us produce insulin, and, you know, the insulin gets delivered to the right places. It's happening all over our bodies constantly. And I thought, ooh, that would be kind of like, you know, I could talk about that. I could do some research and talk about that, because this whole molecular biology stuff just fascinates me. I love this stuff. And recalled with quite high fondness some other ones, podcasts that I've done on how protein folds and, you know, things like that. And so I went to do some research, but there wasn't a ton of stuff aside to say that, in fact, these vesicles have protein keys on the outside of them that are perfectly fit to where their receptacles are that they're supposed to go. And so they are transported to their locations and they lock in place. And when they lock in place, then they are able to deliver their payload. So I hopped on Google looking around for more information about how this all works, and I ended up watching some animations on cells, and then I came across this really cool BBC special. It was an hour long, and I really didn't intend to just spend an hour last night watching it, but the more I watched it, the more fascinating I was, and so I thankfully started taking notes early on and scribbled down a bunch of notes, and hopefully I've got enough notes that I can kind of recall what I was watching. The special was called BBC Universe : The Hidden Life of the Cell. And it not only examined what was going on inside the cell, it also very much examined viruses and how they attack the cells and how cells fight back. And that's really where things got interesting, with a capital I. I had seen a lot of the initial stuff before that they worked through. Things like, you know, we've got 120 trillion cells in our body, trillion with a T. And things like that each cell has a skeleton inside that is built out of proteins, and that within the cell there are these haulers, and these haulers latch on to proteins and things and take them different places. They each have their own receptors, and they can then walk down the skeleton. Literally, they walk down these skeletons. These little haulers are set up. They only go in one direction. But in the animation that they're showing of the research that they've done, these haulers have an upper spot that latches onto a payload, and then the lower portions of it, it has like two little chemical feet, and these chemical feet latch on and release and latch on and release and latch on and release to the skeletal structure, these long ribbons of skeletal structure that are inside the cell, and literally walk down these things. And they said at one point that the animations that they were showing of these little haulers walking down were actually slowed to a considerable degree because these haulers actually take like 100 steps, did they say a second or a minute? I don't know, it's in my notes somewhere. Anyways, they said if we didn't slow them down, they would just be a blur. You couldn't actually tell what was going on. Really fascinating stuff. These little molecular machines that are down in your cells. And what's really important to remember about this is a whole other kind of machinery. Because this machinery is completely chemically based. And it's working down on the nanoscale level. And so you've got proteins that are specifically folded, made out of specific configurations that lock into other things. The whole thing is governed by what's called Brownian motion, this kind of sloshing motion of fluids inside the cell. And as they slosh back and forth, you know, these little things release and catch and release and catch and just down these. It's just so beautiful. Also within the cell, I had heard of mitochondria as well. These are the power stations of the cell, and these mitochondria, according to this thing, had turbines that spin over 1,000 times a minute. Everything we do is powered by the batteries that are charged by these power stations, which is the ATP, a molecule. And I've talked about that before, how this thing spins. It's a rotary engine that's receiving, I think, hydrogen ions and hydrogen atoms, I think. And that causes this thing to spin as it pulls in these hydrogen atoms. And in doing that, then there's this clamping motion that when it opens up, it attracts two pieces of what will become this ATP energy module, and then as it spins, it crunches together and puts them together. So you can spin these things in one direction and they'll make ATP, and you can spin them in another direction and they'll take ATP and break it apart. I mean, it's really beautiful. Beautiful. So you got these mitochondria that are the energy power stations. Everything works, obviously, according to this master plan, because deep down in the nucleus, we have this instruction manual in the DNA of how and what to make and how to organize it. They were saying that within the DNA, we carry two copies, or within the nucleus, we carry two copies of the DNA. There's 6 feet of DNA in every cell in our bodies. And one scientist was saying that if we straightened those all out and laid them end to end in your body as a person, it would go back and forth to the moon thousands of times. Because we have 120 trillion cells. And so you've got these little transcriptors that know exactly where to go in the DNA to produce a certain thing that needs to be produced, and they zip it open, that portion of the DNA, and the RNA transcriptive something or other, again, a little mechanical or a little molecular machine, latches on there and writes out the sequence of RNA that is the copy of that DNA. And then takes that and exports it out of the nucleus. And as it's floating around in the cell, there are these little cellular factories that then pick that up. And from that, make a protein that they spit out that automatically folds into exactly the right configuration. And then these proteins go and do things in the cell or export it out of the cell. And as they start sticking up out of the cell, you've got white blood cells that are patrolling, that are looking at the proteins and determining if they're okay. And if they're not okay, it just absorbs them. I mean, it's just, as they said in the show, it's breathtakingly complex. Just amazing. And then they got to talking in this show how that there was another agent. You've got life sitting over here, these complex, tremendously complex cells that are going through all kinds of operations every minute of every day throughout your 120 trillion cells that are doing all this stuff. They're producing power, they're fueling themselves, they're producing proteins, they're exporting proteins, they're rebuilding themselves when things are being consumed and broken down, the new pieces are being manufactured. It's absolutely astonishing. On the flip side, you have like viruses and bacteria, and specifically viruses that can't really be classified as life, easily classified as life, because they can't reproduce, they do not consume energy, they have no mechanism that allows them to move, but they are insidious. And over in this special, the scientists kept saying, well, you have to understand that life took two different paths. You know, you have complex life and cellular life that produced all this amazing complexity that led to the evolution of all these things. But at the same time, you had viruses, and these viruses figured out, you know, how to piggyback on this complex life and survive and adapt based on this complex life. And, okay, that's fine. But as you go through this stuff, you just keep looking at this stuff and, you know, computer viruses are somewhat, I mean, their analogy, you can make a weak analogy to these viruses, computer viruses, but computer viruses don't just happen. Somebody has to engineer them. And frankly, the more you find out about how these viruses do the work, at least to me, as a designer, as a computer programmer, this feels like they're engineered. So let's go through all this kind of stuff. All right. So here you go. You got these viruses. And the most successful one was the adenovirus. It's responsible for the common cold. It's responsible for pneumonia. In some cases, it's responsible for death. And it's basically just this package. It's just this little protein construction package. Actually, it's a collection of proteins. And inside, it has this little strip of DNA. And that's all it does. That's all it is. It's got nothing to make power. It's got nothing. It's just this construction that's made out of proteins, and it's got this little strip of DNA. And it can spread a number of different ways. It can spread through the air if people sneeze. It can spread through contact. It can spread. It's got to get in somehow. You know, but somebody sneezes and that, somebody breathes that in, or it gets on their skin and then someone touches that and touches their eyes and it's in. You know, it's in the bloodstream. So, the first thing that happens as it's going through there are antibodies, as it's floating through the blood, there are antibodies that if they recognize the virus, they'll attach to the virus and go, hey, key, click. And once these antibodies attach to it, then, like, the white blood cells can come along and go, nope, I don't think you're supposed to be here. And the white blood cells, you know, grab it and destroy it. And that's the end of it. The deliveries that are being put through the blood as well go through endosomes, I think they're called. They're kind of like sorting stations, and the sorting stations look at the chemicals and things that are in the bloodstream and go, I think that's good. No, that isn't good. This is good. That's not good. This is good. And inside, it has special proteins that can produce an area where there's like a little acid bath. And so if it doesn't recognize one of these, it goes, yep, not good. You know, puts it into this acid bath, destroys it. I mean, there's all these mechanisms that can take these viruses out before they ever make it into a cell. But if you don't get that far, then these viruses have these little fibers on them that have these proteins that trick the cell into thinking that, oh, this is okay. So, occasionally in these viruses, these little individual packets of virus, they'll get hauled into the cell. Even at that point, 90% of them will just end up floating around in the cell and never amount to anything and eventually get collected and destroyed. But a few of them, 10% of them, will get picked up by this transport mechanism. I'm getting my mail. One moment. Because there's this transport mechanism, these haulers that we talked about. And some of those will latch on to these little virus packets because they have the right protein configuration. And then the little haulers will start taking this virus down to the nucleus, which is bad. That's what you don't want to happen. And along the way, there's enough congestion on these ribbons that things can get in the way. But occasionally, another hauler will then latch onto the virus. And typically, and the way it will work is that one hauler is only capable of going one direction. I'm backing into my garage. And the other hauler is only capable of going in the opposite direction. But as they jockey back and forth, they actually can transport this virus through all the congestion in the highways that there are of structure inside the cell and can actually get the cell or get this little virus packet down in there closer. Okay, so, oh, there it is. And these little microscopic legs that I mentioned before that are on these haulers, they move 100 steps a second. It's just incredible. Okay, so anyways, said it's been an hour since the virus actually attacked the cell. The nucleus is still an hour away. All right, so they've just discovered, however, that there is actually another mechanism inside the cell that is trying to protect the insides of the cell, just like the antibodies and everything outside the cell are trying to protect it. And so what happens is there's a defense protein that when it latches onto this virus, it starts this chain reaction, and the viruses get tagged for destruction by the machinery that's inside the cell that goes around and cleans up all the garbage. There's these little garbage collectors that go around inside the cell and grab the stuff and tear it apart into raw materials and destroy anything that's a poorly formed protein and all that kind of stuff. It's amazing. So anyway, still though, some viruses get through. And I'm going to start shortening this. You can go watch the video if you want. Some viruses get through. So then this virus packet makes it all the way down to the surface of the nucleus of the cell. And there are tons of gateways in the nucleus where lots and lots and lots of chemical messages are being passed back and forth constantly. The problem is that this virus packet, while it can convince the nucleus that it should be inside, it's too big to pass through these gateways. But it's too big purposefully. And it gets stuck in this gateway. And then what happens is the haulers that are trying to make progress, they think, oh, it must be stuck. I should back up and try again. And so they start pulling on this virus, pulling on its shell, and tugging and pulling and going back and forth. And eventually, they break this virus apart, which is exactly what the virus wants to happen. Because when it breaks apart that little strip of DNA that's been sitting in there all this time, then slips through and gets into the inside of the cell. And at that point, it's all over. Because as soon as that happens and it gets inside there, the machinery that's inside the nucleus really can't tell the difference between your DNA and this little strip of DNA. And it is a little strip of DNA. According to the show, our DNA has about 23,000 genes that code for thousands of proteins, thousands and thousands of proteins. This strip of DNA in this virus only has 40 genes. But those 40 genes can wreak havoc on the inside of that cell. And as one researcher said, it's brilliant. Because the first thing it starts to do when the transcribers start transcribing is it starts sending out all these messages, and those messages actually produce proteins that shut down all the normal functioning of the cell. So all the defense mechanisms go down, all the power mechanisms go down in this cell, everything goes down. And then what it does is it starts manufacturing in the nucleus. These transcribers start manufacturing more of the virus and building the virus modules around it and attaching all the things, but it's all down still in the nucleus. And so they said by 24 hours later or 48 hours later, 24 hours later, the virus has complete control over the cell. Routine maintenance is stopped. The cell is committed to building a new army. It self-assembles. It turns out that the virus that attacks us are made of the same stuff. So there's already binding sites for the transport. Oh. My wife is coming out. One moment. How's it going, sweetie? I'm not quite done with my podcast.
It's fine. I've just got stinky trash.
Oh, stinky trash. Well, I'll take it out. If you just want to leave it there, I can get it. Anyways, but there's still a problem because the viruses have to get outside this nucleus. And so at just the right time, what happens is that these instructions then produce proteins that start breaking down the skeletal structure of the cell and produce proteins which weaken the fiber of the nucleus to where it just bursts. And now you've got all these new viruses that are released into cells. And the cold is on its way and the pneumonia is on its way. But even at that point, the body starts mounting this defense because as soon as it sees that there's all these new viruses out there, and as soon as it gets an antibody that can attach to it, it starts producing all these antibodies, and it starts producing all these white blood cells and just starts flooding that area so that it can get control of this virus that happens. And they were even saying that cells that are next to this cell that has just died, those cells can sense when a cell has expired due to viruses and things, and those cells actually commit suicide and destroy themselves to keep themselves from getting infected. I mean, it is gorgeous. It's gorgeous. And one of the scientists in this show, I think it was in this show, made the statement that the more we learn about outer space and the more we learn about the cosmos, it seems like the simpler it gets. But the more we learn about biology and our cells and how they work, the more complex it gets. And this just brought to mind again this thing I've been saying for a while about the third wave of science. That the second wave of science shows us the complexity to the point where we don't want to ponder a designer that would have the capability of creating that. And so we reject the idea of a designer. But what the third wave of science does is finally produces so much evidence of such a high degree of complexity and balance that we then begin to begrudgingly admit that there really must be a designer. And I know I'm biased, but when I see, first of all, the gorgeous, brilliant complexity of a cell, and then when I see this tiny, tiny little virus that is not alive, and yet seems to be specifically engineered and designed to capitalize on the complexity of our cells. It just feels like, to me, that it's a stretch to say that could have all just happened. I don't care if we've had 4 billion years. You can take all the pieces of a watch and shake them around in a bag for 4 billion years, and you aren't going to necessarily get a watch. And our cells are far more complicated than a pocket watch. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.